My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of talking with Sarah Dunnett. Sarah, welcome to Portland, and welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Ed. Nice to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you. Let me read a little bit about you. You're a novelist, a broadcaster. You've seen a microphone before.
Oh, yes. I'm familiar with them.
You're born in London, worked as an actress, and began working as a BBC producer for, Radio 4?
Yep.
In 1974, you've been a presenter of Radio 4's Woman's Hour and BBC Television's The Late Show. What does The Late Show do?
It was a program about culture. It was a late-night program every night talking about culture and what was going on in the city and how it connected to politics. It was really a great and interesting show to work on.
Sounds good to me. Yeah, I like that. You've won several awards for your fiction. You used to write detective novels.
I did indeed. I wrote a series of three detective novels with a heroine called Hannah Wolfe and then a couple of thrillers.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to do that anymore?
No, I really don't. I'm very happy what I'm doing now.
Oh, in a way, that's a shame because I haven't read them, but I'm going to look them up, and I'm sure you're great at it. You currently live in London. Your novel, The Birth of Venus, in 2003, terrific book. I love the book. And the opening scene is great, and we discover... Tell us what we discover.
We discover that an old woman who's in a convent has had some kind of illness that people think is a tumor. But when they take the clothes off her body, which they have to because there's a plague going around, they have to burn the clothes, they discover that the tumor actually is a pig's bladder that's been self-applied. And on her body, rather more shockingly, is a tattoo of a snake, which curves right down across her chest and her stomach to her groin, and the snake's face is that of a man with his tongue coming out.
Ooh, yeah. I didn't know I wanted to go any further than that, but I did. I read the whole book.
Well, what I wanted to do was to make people interested in reading the rest of the book. And when you're writing historical novels, you have to find a way to grab your audience and let them leave the computer, the ironing, the dishwasher, whatever, and really take them back viscerally into the past. So you need to think of a way of doing that. And I think a lot about the openings of novels for that reason.
Well, we have a new one now, which is entitled Sacred Hearts. This is the paperback edition, and it's published by Random House. Your name, Sarah Dunnett, D-U-N-A-N-T. Renaissance Italy, both books, the one we just discussed and your latest one, Renaissance Italy. What is there about Renaissance Italy that attracts you so much?
Oh, I just don't think there was another period like it in the whole of Western history, really. Somewhere between 20 and 30 years during the early 15th century, in this tiny little city of Florence, you know, probably no bigger than Portland, a cultural revolution
probably
took
smaller.
Place. Yeah, may yeah. well have been smaller than yeah. Portland. A cultural revolution took place. Everything changed. The rediscovery of classicism, the ability to make art, understand perspective, so people started to look like flesh and blood, religious thinking changed, political thinking changed. The city was very rich. There were people with loads of money who were patrons of the art, and the architecture and the art just exploded everywhere around you. And I just, when I was writing The Birth of Venus, I just thought, wouldn't it be extraordinary to write a novel which made you feel like you were there? Not a page in the history book, ooh, the Renaissance, wasn't it amazing? But actually the smells and the taste and the excitement of being there. And that's how The Birth of Venus came. And then I then went on to write a novel about courtesan culture, high-class prostitutes, who also operated in the Renaissance in Rome and in Venice. And by the time I finished that second book, I knew I had to go into a convent, Ed, because I knew by that time that really this terrifying statistic that by the end of the 16th century, it was so expensive because of dowries to marry off your daughter that if you were born in a well-bred family, it was very likely that there was only enough money to marry one, maybe two daughters. The other daughters, because they couldn't be left at home, they'd become sexual now in inverted commas, so they were tempting to men, had to actually be married to Jesus Christ. That was the way you kept them secure. So something like half of all well-bred women in northern Italy were in convents, whether or not they wanted to be.
You know, people may know about primogeniture, where the first son inherits everything, and the second son would usually go into the army. They would purchase a commission in the army, and if there were a third son, he would take the cloth. I did not know until I read the book that sort of thing prevailed as well with dowries for girls. Dowries are very important.
Very important. And, of course, the difference is that although the boys may go into the cloth, particularly at the period of history I'm writing at in the Renaissance, although that meant they had to be celibate, i.e. they couldn't get married, it doesn't mean they have to be chaste. you know, this is a very deliciously corrupt period in late Catholicism, just before the Protestants and just after Luther. And so actually for the men, it was a win-win situation. You didn't necessarily get married. You had a good job in the church, but you could still have sexual relations with the women. Chastity and celibacy meant the same thing, which is why the walls of the convents were so high.
Yeah, I think one of the great oxymorons in history is Borgia Pope.
So, absolutely. More children than we've had hot dinners.
That's right. Yeah, the cardinals had more children than their parishioners did, and with more women. Let's talk about the convent is Santa Caterina in Milano. Right?
In Ferrara.
I'm sorry, that's right. Yes, forgive me. One of the characters is from Milano.
Yeah.
And Ferrara is not Milan. It's not Florence. It's not Venice. It's a backwater, really.
Ferrara is one of the best-kept secrets in historical Renaissance Italy, and it's still one of the best-kept secrets now in terms of tourist traps in Italy. You know, I have written The Birth of Venus was set in Florence. In the Company of the Courtesan was set in Venice. I deliberately wanted to pick a city here that actually, if you were willing to take a little more time when you went to Italy, you would be astounded. Because Ferrara has one of the most complete medieval quarters that I've ever seen, and also a perfect Renaissance part of the city too, with a bloody great castle in the middle where the D'Este family ruled from. And it was filled with convents. Lucrezia Borgia ends up in Ferrara because she marries into the royal family there, and she's buried in one of the convents. Ferrara still has two enclosed convents to this day where young women or older women go in as nuns and never come out. Mm-hmm. And Sacred Hearts, the convent in Sacred Hearts, is based on one of those convents. It's got the same architecture, and I went to visit it while I was writing the novel.
Now, where in Italy is Ferrara? I haven't been there.
It's in the Po Valley, so it's nearer to Venice. It's in the northeast. Mm-hmm. So it just borders the Venetian Empire and it borders the Papal State. So it was quite a kind of linchpin in the power structure of 16th century Italy.
And Italy, as we know it today, did not exist. It was a bunch of city-states, Papal States.
Oh, it's extraordinary. It was like a chessboard. Really, it was like a chessboard with a whole series of major players, both pawns and kings and queens, moving in order to try and take each one out. I mean, there was a great deal of creativity and a great deal of energy in it because there were so many little states jostling for power, and there were so many patrons in these little states employing or trying to seduce out Michelangelo or Fra Angelico or Leonardo to do work in their cities, that it was an extremely vibrant place. But it was also extremely brutal. You know, one of the things that people I don't think understand about the Renaissance is they think about it as this gorgeous period. Oh, the art. Oh, how wonderful. Well, along with the beauty came a lot of brutality. And it's very interesting when you're writing about history to be able to show both the darkness and the light and the sheer kind of visceral, physical pain of it all, too.
Do you remember that famous speech by Orson Welles in The Third Man where he says...
The cuckoo clock.
Yes, Italy was at war. There was murder in the streets for hundreds of years, and it gave us Michelangelo and the Renaissance. Switzerland was at peace for all the time, and it gave us the cuckoo clock. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's a great line from one of my favorite movies. Let's talk about Suara Zuana. Suara means Sister Zuana.
Yeah.
She is the dispensary mistress. Mm-hmm. She's an herbalist and a healer. And she is, we kind of see the book from her point of view.
Yeah.
Wonderful character. Tell us about Zuana.
Well, what interested me when I started to write about convents, I think I initially had the same reaction that I expect even many people listening to this will have, which will be, oh, a convent. I'm not sure I want to spend an entire book in a convent. That must be a pretty miserable place. And initially when I started writing the book, I had some of the same feelings, not least because as a 21st century woman, you think, these poor women, they didn't have a choice. They were just shoved in there. But of course, the interesting thing about writing in the past is that our sensibilities now don't bear any resemblance to what their lives was like. And actually, when you do the research, and there's a lot of it now, to your surprise, you find that living in a convent might have been a hell of a lot better than living outside. You know, outside convents, these young women at the age of 15, 16 will be married off to somebody they don't know, probably don't like, certainly don't love, and they'd spend the rest of their lives having children. Many of them would die in childbirth. Lots of them would bury their own infant children. And if they had a proclivity or a creativity to do anything else, there wasn't any time. They were wives and mothers. Whereas, ironically, inside the convent walls, though they didn't get married and they didn't have sex, although I'll tell you maybe later a few did, actually, what they could
do... Why am
do
I not surprised to hear that?
What they could do was express themselves in ways that wouldn't have been allowed outside. So you have women writing plays, you have women composing music, and you have a character like Swaraswana, whose father was a medical doctor at a university in Ferrara. He dies, she hasn't got enough money, she's put into the convent along with all his books. Within a year, she's running a herb garden, then she's got a little distillery, then she's got a dispensary, and then she's got all of these nuns in her care to look after. She's the nearest ed that a woman could get to being a doctor. And that's the extraordinary thing about these convents, that, you know, in Sacred Hearts, yes, it looks like imprisonment at one level, but actually, it's quite free and creative in others.
Yeah, so one of the things that I found fascinating is that the social structure outside the convent is in some way replicated inside the convent, in the sense that there are social strata. There are the conversas, which are apparently girls from not so wealthy families,
yep.
And there are the choir nuns, which are the daughters of the wealthy.
Yes,
and
yes.
Then, well, of course, novices can be of either kind. But also, there is a democracy in there which existed almost nowhere in the world.
Oh, certainly for women.
Tell us about chapter meetings.
Yeah. Oh, this was, when I found out about these chapter meetings, it was fantastic, which is, you know, each office in the convent, from the abbess down through the choir mistress, through the woman who runs the kitchens and the storerooms and the watch sister, are all voted in. And all of the nuns vote together. Now, this is extraordinary. There is no democratic structure where women vote anywhere in Europe for about four centuries later, actually. Now, of course, like all democracies, there's a certain amount of give and take in here. And because there's family factions at work, the biggest families control the convents. And so you buy in a little group of votes from the choir nun if you give their loyalty to this, etc. So there's bargaining going on there. It's politics, actually. That's the wonder of it. It's like a little republic of women in there. But what that means is people who are good at politics have a very good time there. And throughout history, you come across really powerful women who become abbesses. You know, now, this is in a time when no women had any political power. And yet, here is a woman like the abbess in
the
book,
yeah.
Madame Chiara, and she is basically running a state. And she's balancing all the factions, the young women who just want to wear the latest fashions under their garments, some who are completely religious and want to make the place a much more rigid structure, others who just want to get on with writing their plays or doing their work. And it's her job to run the state. And when I first published the book, there was a review from Seattle, very close to here actually, where the literary editor said, I kept thinking of Hillary Clinton, you know, because you have to make moral choices if you get involved in power, and sometimes they can be dodgy ones, and do the ends justify the means? And that's what these women were like. They would have been running governments, or they would have been CEOs.
Well, you know, I was thinking when I thought of the abbess is that she may have been married to Jesus, but she certainly consorted with Machiavelli, so...
That's absolutely true.
Yes. I'd like to remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Sarah Dunant. The title of her book is Sacred Hearts, published by Random House. The women in the convent, as you say, cover the range of devotion and personal, you know, how they conduct themselves when they're alone in their cells, what they're thinking. Mm-hmm. Do you remember a poem by Browning, Soliloquy in a Spanish Cloister?
Oh, I don't know it.
It's about a Spanish cloister of monks, and one loathes and despises another monk so badly, and that's what the whole poem is about, is plotting revenge and deaths for this rival monk. And it made me think of this when I read your book, because that kind of intrigues, those kind of intrigues are going on in the book.
Oh, yes, it's funny, isn't it? Because it's a convent, one sort of thinks that they'll all be good, in inverted commas. But as anybody knows, and I've actually had a number of emails and letters from people, women living in convents, who've read the book saying, you've completely got it. You know, on the surface it may look okay, but we're just a bunch of people too. We have our own weaknesses, we fight our own battles with our own feelings, you know, be they jealousy or boredom or whatever. And certainly within this convent there are factions moving in. I suppose the most powerful one being Suara Umiliana, who wants to see this convent run on a much tight leash lane. She really wants it to be more religious, and more kind of fundamentally religious, which would be fine for some of the nuns and a nightmare for the others who didn't come in because God was the most important thing in their lives. And so she's trying to take over the convent, and it's the way in which the power play starts to take place. And in the middle of it, as a kind of pawn in the game, is this very young novice who comes in, and the book opens with this, screaming her lungs out because she doesn't want to stay and she's determined to get out. She also happens to have the most beautiful singing voice. And because a beautiful singing voice in a convent meant that your choir became famous, and the more people who listened to your choir, the better the benefactors were and the more money who came in. Actually, everybody wants this young nun. In some cases to become a religious figure, in some cases to become the chief singer. And it's really who will win her, and will she or will she not get out?
Yeah, I want to talk about the politics of the church at the time and how it was affecting what was going on inside the convent. But just, I have to mention the names that you chose for each of the nuns. Mm-hmm. Umiliana.
Yeah.
There was very little humility or humbleness about this woman at all. You know,
wonderful irony, isn't
it? You can do stuff like that when you write a novel. There was a lot going on in the greater church, in the Church of Rome in those days, about the Reformation had happened, the Protestant Reformation, and the church was still reeling from being attacked.
Yeah.
But like this, and it was painful for two reasons. It was painful because the attacks were very vicious, and it was painful because they were mostly true.
Yes.
So the church was trying to get itself straight and figure out, what the heck do we do now? And tell us how that affected what was going on inside the convent.
You know, it's been so interesting for me since this book came out, watching the unfolding of this massive row about child abuse within the Catholic Church now, because it strikes me it's exactly the same thing. An institution as big and as confident and, in a sense, up until now, as unattackable as the Catholic Church, just does not expect to have to be held accountable, always thinks that what it does is acceptable. So in the same way that nowadays it's taking a great deal for the Catholic Church to admit culpability in the cover-ups of child abuse, you know, 5 or 6 centuries ago, when Luther was yelling insults at the Catholic Church, rather than the Catholic Church taking seriously what Luther was saying, because there was no doubt he put his finger on massive corruption, the church's response was just to close down and get more fierce and more rigid, really, which was such a shame. And in particular, Luther's attack is about nuns and monks and about the scandals going on in convents and monasteries because so many people are there because they don't want to be. Now, Luther knows a thing or two because he is a monk, right? And he leaves his monastery in order to marry a nun who leaves her convent. So, you know, he is just an example of the kind of tensions between men and women that there also are in religion.
Sounds like a good setup for a limerick, too. So.
We'll work on that one,
yeah.
And so the Council of Trent, which is the way that the Counter-Reformation comes about to protect the Catholic Church, at the very last minute suddenly says to itself, my God, what are we going to do about the nuns? There's all this scandal about the nuns. And rather than think properly about what they should do, they just decide to enclose them all. So even orders that had dispensations to go out and work with the poor or whatever, suddenly all nuns everywhere within the Catholic faith were incarcerated in their convents. And they sent out what they called visitations of bishops and officials to go into convents and to check that nobody was reading the wrong books and that actually polyphony, that beautiful music which used lots and lots of different strains and voices. Now, that wasn't okay because you couldn't hear the words and we should be talking about worshipping God. So they took away part of their orchestras. They stopped them singing as beautifully as they had. They tried to stop them writing plays and performing them. And they also did things like built up the walls of the convents higher to make sure no one could get in. And in one particular case, there's a line that says, and the last five or six courses of bricks will have no mortar in them. So if anybody wants to put a ladder against them to get in or get out, they'll fall over and break their necks. That's the level of kind of paranoia that was going on. So women who up until now had ironically, quite a lot of freedom and creativity inside the convents suddenly begin to lose it. And it's almost like you can hear their voices howling as the walls get higher.
Mm-hmm. The original church liturgy was in what they call plain chant.
Yeah.
No harmonies, everybody singing the same notes. And that was nice. It's beautiful. I love that stuff. Gregorian chants are in plain chant. But eventually, the wonderful musicians of Italy and France and Spain started adding harmonies. And that annoyed some church fathers, just like, I suppose, conservatives of any religion are annoyed by any innovation and will seek to destroy it.
Yes, and it's so painful what happens in music in the 16th century. As you say, the arrival of polyphony. Oh, polyphony is so amazing. Suddenly a whole series of voices sing together, and it's like a shoal of fish darting in and out of the sea. It's so beautiful.
And it's very descriptive. It's a good visual.
And women were very good at it. And what was so amazing about this period of time, Ed, is that women could perform publicly in these convents, right? Vespers, like Evensong, was open to the church. You know, other people came into the public church and heard them. And if you had a really good convent choir, you became quite famous. And this is at a time when it's not okay for well-bred women to perform in public in any other way. You know, this Sacred Hearts is set in 1570. Shakespeare's, 6 years old. He's going to write a whole series of plays in which great women parts are all played by men because it's not okay for women to be on stage.
Right.
So it's very exciting for these women to be out there singing until, of course, they're not allowed to anymore. So they take the organs away, they actually ban polyphony, and it gets boring. The walls are built up behind them, and even the sound coming out of them gets more boring.
Oh, some will say that's the way it's supposed to be. I want to talk about Serafina, who was a young woman who was incarcerated, for want of a better word, against her will in the convent. And both Sister Zuana and the abbess take an interest in her for many reasons, but she goes through agonies because she wants to be out of there. She has a boyfriend, and she wants to be with a boyfriend, and she hates the fact that she was put there against her will. And at some point, she begins to starve herself. And I'm thinking, one of the modern concepts of anorexia is that it's a way you have of controlling your own body. Did you think about that when you...
It's a really interesting, rich conversation going on now among historians, too, of this period, because one of the things we know about all of these medieval women who did have visions and who did have ecstasies, became very powerful figures in the church, like Catherine of Siena and people like that, is many of them either suffered from illnesses that wasted their body, or they went on extremely strict regimes of self-starvation. And what is fascinating about this is, as you rightly say, this is at a time when they had no control at all. They had no choice in the world. Maybe the only choice they had was to rather, if they put something in their mouth and didn't. Now we live in an era where actually you could say rather tragically, young women have so much choice that it's equally unbearable, the cacophony around them. And so deciding to control what they eat is one way of kind of controlling their lives and the chaos in their lives. I did a lot of research as to the impacts of anorexia, and what really astonished me was how similar the biochemical effects of this disease were when you looked at what it did to young women now and young women then. Because, of course, if you don't eat for a long enough period of time, you go through massive mood swings. You go through elations and a kind of adrenaline highs, and then you go through terrible lassitudes and depressions. After consistent starvation, you start to hear voices. You start actually to semi-hallucinate. Now the voices are a version of somebody saying, don't eat the apple, leave it alone. In the past, what we are pretty clear is that they began to think the voices were either God or the devil. But in the biochemical impact of starvation, whichever century you're in, it does something to people's brains. And it became so fascinating to me, this idea that women used the same thing when they didn't have control of their lives. But in both cases, it gives them power. If you've ever met a young anorexic, you will know that although it's destructive power, the world revolves around them because everyone's so terrified for them and of them. Whereas in the past, if you became a visionary in a convent, suddenly from being nobody, you became somebody. You would gain power. So it's one of the many ways, I think, that when you're looking at the past, even if you don't go in there deliberately to say something about the present, it throws up stuff that so illuminates what's going on nowadays.
You know, there's one of the nuns, Sister Magdalena, is an ecstatic,
yeah.
And she has been starving herself for nobody remembers how long any longer. Mm. And the only thing I could think of when you described her was that incredible statue of Saint Teresa in ecstasy, the Bernini statue, yeah. Which is probably one of my half dozen greatest favorite pieces of art in the world. It's in a little tiny church in Rome near the train station. It's a small little place, and there's several examples of world-class art in there, but the statue is brilliant. And when I thought of Sister Magdalena, that's what I thought of.
Yes,
did you have that in your mind? Or?
Well, that's a very interesting statue by Bernini because it's in marble, so it's very beautiful. And there's an angel who's basically throwing down a kind of stigmata towards her body. And she has her head flung back in the most fabulous, and one has to say the most potentially erotic,
orgasmic
ecstasy. Yes. In fact, there's a very funny story of I think it's a 19th century French aristocrat who goes in there and looks at it and says, "Oh my God, if this is God, then I have had it often."
Oh, the angel's holding a golden arrow.
Well, that's it.
Yes, and he's about to pierce her heart with a golden arrow.
Yeah.
And there's not too much symbolism in that at all, is there?
It's a hard one, actually, because, of course, post-Sigmund Freud, every time you see things like that, you do think of sexuality. You do think that women's hysteria is always to do with repressed sexuality. And I must say that one of the hardest things about writing about the past is you don't have just to airbrush out all the buildings that didn't exist, or the sanitation, or all of that kind of stuff, or the analgesics, or the painkillers. You have to also airbrush out intellectual ideas. And I think it's not deep enough. It's just to say, oh, these women didn't have men in their life, so they had a sexual relationship with Christ. It's more complicated. It's more nuanced. It's more interesting than that.
Well, Freud definitely was a gift to those of us with dirty minds. I would not certainly argue that. What are you working on now?
I am in that moment when my brain is empty.
Is that right?
Which is a moment of terror, but you do know that it can't be filled with anything until it's empty. It's a difficult one, this, because, as you can tell, I'm really interested in this period and I'm really interested in these nuns and what happened to them. But now I have to leave them be. I have to let go of the characters that have been living with me for the best part of 2 or 3 years in order to make room for others to come in. And that's when you get scared, but you have to get scared in order for the next idea to come.
We only have about a minute and a half, but I was going to ask you this, so you have to compress your answer, unfortunately.
Okay.
But in The Birth of Venus, the arrival of Savonarola,
yeah.
a lunatic, a madman, a guy who... We see his analogs today, mm-hmm. and even in imams, people of such intense religious feeling that they know they are right, and they know the only true way to God, and in the convent in Sacred Hearts, I'm thinking of the ability of the religious community to warp culture within a certain way. Do you know what I'm asking here?
Yeah, and in fact, gosh, it's a shame we've only got a minute and a half, because I think that one of the most interesting things about writing historical fiction now set in a period when everybody believed in God and it made some of them behave in absolutely outrageous and fanatical ways is something that's very helpful to now us in the present, because we're in a time when religion's ruling global politics again. And one of the things that we need to understand, if we are not religious ourselves, is exactly what fuels this and what it does to personality and how it makes people behave. So it's all very well to have the Richard Dawkins of the world saying it's wrong, they're stupid, but unless we understand it, we're not going to be able to defeat it. And so when I'm writing books now set deep in religious sensibilities, I think, goodness, I have a lot to learn here which will help me to deal with the strange present which I find myself living in.
Even though I agree with Dawkins about most of everything he says, he's pretty ineffective. He's not going to have any effect on anybody, really. Anybody,
well,
you know.
He's a messianic figure. He an anti-messianic doesn't believe figure. In God so powerfully that he might as well be believing.
That's very astute. I agree completely. This has been so much fun talking to you. I've been speaking with Sarah Dunant, D-U-N-A-N-T. Sacred Hearts is the name of her book. It's a paperback published by Random House. Please come back again.
I'd love to. Thank you.